This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Hello and welcome. I'm Natalie Pynchon and I'll be reading synopses of some of the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery on November 7th, 2014. The topics of the articles featured in this podcast are hydrocephalus, anatomy, traumatic brain injury, stereotactic radiosurgery, neurosurgical history, surgical technique, and vascular disorders. Cost-consequence analysis of antibiotic impregnated shunts and external ventricular drains in hydrocephalus. A clinical article by Natalie Edwards and colleagues. Despite multiple preventive strategies for reducing infection, up to 15% of patients with shunt catheters and 27% of patients with external ventricular drains may develop an infection. Mounting evidence suggests that the use of antimicrobial impregnated shunt and external ventricular drain catheters may help minimize infection rates in hydrocephalus treatment. The authors utilized decision analytic modeling techniques to estimate the clinical and economic consequences of using antibiotic impregnated shunts and external ventricular drains from a hospital perspective. Model inputs were derived from the published peer-reviewed literature. The value analysis demonstrated that evidence supports the use of antibiotic impregnated catheters as effective and potentially cost-saving treatments. In 100 patients requiring shunts, the use of antibiotic impregnated catheters may be associated with 0.5 fewer deaths, 71 fewer hospital days, 11 fewer surgeries, and $128,228 of net savings in hospital costs due to decreased infection. In 100 patients requiring external ventricular drains, the use of antibiotic impregnated catheters may be associated with 2.7 fewer deaths and 82 fewer hospital days due to infection. Also, the relative risk of more severe neurological impairment was estimated to be more than 5 times greater with external ventricular drain infection. Decreases in infection with antibiotic impregnated external ventricular drains resulted in an estimated $264,069 of net savings per 100 patients treated. Gruber's ligament as a useful landmark for the abducens nerve in the transnasal approach, a laboratory investigation by Ryosuke Tomio and co-authors. Expanded endoscopic transnasal surgeries for skull-based lesions have recently become popular. Some expert surgeons have performed endoscopic transclival removal of tumors, and they have reported a risk of abducens nerve injuries. The microsurgical anatomy of the abducens nerve has been described many times by well-known authors. However, no one has described an anatomical landmark of the abducens nerve in the interdural space, also called Dorello's canal, in the transnasal transclival view. In this study, the authors show that Gruber's ligament is the most reliable landmark of the abducens nerve in this view using cadaver dissection. This study was performed with 10 adult cadaveric heads. Gruber's ligament was found in this interdural space near the posterior clinoid process. The abducens nerve could be safely exposed along Gruber's ligament inferolaterally. The authors confirmed the intersection of the abducens nerve and Gruber's ligament in this lateral interdural space in all 10 heads. To avoid abducens nerve injury, the dissection should start from the superomedial part of the clivus to first recognize Gruber's ligament, and then the inferolateral part can be safely exposed along Gruber's ligament. Gruber's ligament was thus considered a useful landmark of the abducens nerve in this interdural space. Hypertonic saline reduces cumulative and daily intracranial pressure burdens after severe traumatic brain injury. A clinical article by Halinder Singh Mangat and co-workers. Hyperosmotic agents have been used for several years to treat raised intracranial pressure after traumatic brain injury. However, there is little evidence to support the use of mannitol over hypertonic saline. In this article, the authors explore the effects of these two agents on the reduction of daily and cumulative intracranial pressure burdens after severe traumatic brain injury. The daily intracranial pressure burden was calculated as the mean number of hours per day that intracranial pressure was greater than 25 millimeters of mercury. The total number of days on which intracranial pressure was greater than 25 millimeters of mercury was used as cumulative intracranial pressure days. 25 patients from the group that received hypertonic saline were compared to the patients who were given mannitol after being matched 1-to-1 and 1-to-2 for factors that affect outcome after traumatic brain injury, namely Glasgow Coma Score, pupillary abnormality, hypotension, and the need for craniotomy. Age and brain CT scan abnormalities were comparable between the groups. The use of hypertonic saline resulted in a significantly greater reduction in cumulative and daily intracranial pressure burdens than did mannitol. Hypertonic saline use also resulted in a significant reduction in the number of ICU days. The reductions in intracranial pressure burden and in ICU days make hypertonic saline a preferable agent in treating raised intracranial pressure after severe traumatic brain injury. Frameless robotic stereotactic biopsies, a consecutive series of 100 cases. A clinical article by Michel Lefranc and colleagues. Stereotactic biopsies are an everyday part of neurosurgery. This procedure must provide an accurate histological diagnosis with the lowest possible morbidity and an easy workflow. Robotic stereotactic biopsy has to be an accurate, safe, frameless, and rapid technique to become an interesting method. In this article, the authors report the clinical results of their first series of 100 frameless robotic biopsies using a new robotic device, the ROSA from MedTech. Stereotactic surgery was performed in the supine position for 93 cases and in the prone position for 7 cases. The use of fiducial markers was reserved for posterior fossa biopsy via a transcerebellar approach, via an occipital approach, or pediatric biopsy. A histological diagnosis was obtained in 97 patients. No deaths or permanent morbidity related to the surgery were observed. 6 patients experienced transient neurological worsening. 6 cases of bleeding within the lesion or along the biopsy trajectory were observed on postoperative CT scan, but were associated with transient clinical modifications in only 2 cases. ROSA frameless stereotactic biopsy may allow for accurate and safe robotized frameless procedures. William H. Findel, 1918-2014. A historical vignette by Richard LeBlanc and Mark Prohl. Dr. William Bill Findall was one of the world's most distinguished neurosurgeons and a brilliant neuroscientist. He was the third director of the Montreal Neurological Institute, succeeding Theodore Rasmussen and Wilder Penfield. Dr. Findall was a visionary neurosurgeon, having been trained at McGill by Wilder Penfield, William Cohn, and Arthur Elvidge. His scientific passions were the study of epilepsy, brain imaging, brain tumors, and the function of the human brain, while his intense historical interests focused on Thomas Willis. Born of relatively humble parentage in Nova Scotia, Bill won a Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford, in the same track as his mentor Wilder Penfield, focusing on neurophysiology and neuroanatomy. He studied and worked at the National Hospital in Queen Square, London. Not only a premier scientist and neurosurgeon, in every sense, Bill Findall brought to grand, modern, physical fruition the dreams of Penfield at the Montreal Neurological Institute. Bill was level-headed, practical, and unafraid to take on the lobbying and the work to acquire the most advanced scientific technology. Dr. Findall was a kind, patient, intelligent, thoughtful, and caring mentor for the young people who invariably gravitated to him. His inviting smile and the twinkle in his eye complemented a great sense of humor. A pioneer in his own right, Dr. Findall linked the modern neurosurgical world with a legacy of the first generations of important neurosurgeons and neuroscientists. Intracranial inertial cavitation threshold and thermal ablation lesion creation using MRI-guided 220 kHz focused ultrasound surgery. Preclinical investigation. A laboratory investigation by Ziyuan Zhu and co-authors. Transcranial MR-guided focused ultrasound, which utilizes a 650 kHz MR-guided focused ultrasound system, has emerged as a novel, minimally invasive, and ionization radiation-free treatment modality for various intracranial diseases. Low-frequency ultrasound using 220 kHz has the advantages of less phase aberration when passing the skull bone and a relatively greater ablative volume achieved in a reasonable time frame compared with that of a high-frequency ultrasound system. However, low-frequency ultrasound is prone to acoustic cavitation formation. The inertial cavitation likely arising from the low-frequency ultrasound may result in thermal and/or mechanical injury to normal brain tissue adjacent to the clinical target, which is devastating and potentially fatal. The safety of this system is largely unknown. In this study, the authors created for the first time a thermal ablation lesion in the thalamus, evidenced by MRI and histology studies, by selecting the acoustic parameters in a live swine model. Meanwhile, an inertial cavitation threshold was identified by varying the acoustic power and durations. Therefore, these findings may provide extremely important information with respect to the avoidance of inertial cavitation-induced tissue damage to pave the way for future clinical trials using low-frequency ultrasound. Smoking is not associated with recurrence and retreatment of intracranial aneurysms after endovascular coiling. A clinical article by Walid Brinjiki and co-workers. The authors performed a study that examined the effect of tobacco smoking on healing of aneurysms after endovascular coiling of the aneurysms. Previous studies have suggested that patients who smoke have higher rates of aneurysm recurrence and retreatment, possibly because of decreased healing of the aneurysm due to the inflammatory effects of smoking. In their study, with 384 patients having a combined total of 411 aneurysms, the authors found that smoking was not associated with aneurysm recurrence and retreatment. The authors also performed a separate analysis, controlling for other factors that are known to increase the risk of aneurysm recurrence and retreatment, including aneurysm size, rupture status, and initial occlusion status. In this adjusted analysis, smoking was again not associated with aneurysm recurrence and retreatment. The authors conclude that smoking is not an independent risk factor for aneurysm recurrence and retreatment after endovascular treatment. However, the authors recommend that patients who have intracranial aneurysms continue to be counseled about the risks of tobacco smoking. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.